this class, since we only have one book. It just so happens that the book that we're studying is very unique in a lot of different respects, as we'll see in just a minute. So I had a quotation up here, but we can't see it. So the quotation essentially talked about the unique character of Hebrews and the fact that there are several things about it that make it distinctive from other New Testament books. This is also on a very basic level in terms of the language. The language of the book of Hebrews is different than any other New Testament book, and it's different in the sense that the Greek in which the New Testament is written in, or in which Hebrews is written in, is better than that of any other book, as I said, in the New Testament. I think there are something like 150 words that occur in Hebrews that don't occur anywhere else in the New Testament. 90 words occur in Hebrews and only occur once elsewhere in the New Testament. Again, what does that tell us? Well, that tells us that this writer, I think his education level, his ability to write, was higher than that of the other New Testament writers. And I don't think there's anything to concern us about that. I mean, I think we all know that, right? Did all the New Testament writers have the same amount of education? Well, of course not. I don't think that's realistic. I also don't think that's something that we are expected to presume at any rate. I also want to begin with something else, though, because there are some questions about Hebrews that we have to ask, and we can't necessarily answer them. And it reminds me of the maxim that formed the heading of a book a few years ago, and that is, we cannot show what we cannot know. And you could also make the argument that it goes the other way around. We cannot know what we cannot show. I'm not going to pretend to have all the answers about this book, because I don't. And I'll be very forthright about that. And you'll see that even in our introductory lesson. Okay, so this is the quotation that I was referring to from Attridge's commentary on Hebrews. He says, "The document known as the Epistle to Hebrews, the Hebrews, is the most elegant and sophisticated and perhaps the most enigmatic text of first century Christianity. It may be characterized as a masterpiece of early Christian rhetorical homiletics." Now, just so we're all clear, what does enigmatic mean? Anybody know? What's an enigma? What? Unique. It can mean unique, but it can also mean what? It's difficult, okay? It's a little bit obscure. And so I think you have both of those meanings maybe encompassed here in this word. So see, here are some of the questions that I was referring to. Did Paul write it? I think in just a minute we'll answer that question. I hope pretty easily with a no. But I know when you hear people talk about Hebrews, they'll say the author. And I think what that indicates is, for the most part, most people assume Paul didn't write it. And so I suppose we could just skip that issue altogether, but I don't want to do that. I think we have an opportunity here maybe to look at why that's not really entertained seriously anymore, because I think the arguments are pretty compelling with regard to that. Another question. Well, if Paul didn't write it, then who wrote it? And I think sometimes we feel this inclination that we have to know who the author is. And I think that is a mistake, as we'll see. What's the genre of Hebrews? What does genre mean? And again, please, I'm not trying to insult anybody. I just want to make sure we all understand this terminology. What is genre?
Was it poetry, history, or...
Exactly. What kind of book is it? That's basically what we're asking. What's the date? That's another question that I don't think we can solve very, very easily. And then, and you know what? All this other stuff, all these other questions, I don't think necessarily... necessarily impinge directly on how we interpret the work. The last question does. What is the situation of the addressees? In other words, what are they going through? What occasioned this text to be written? Because we have to understand something about writings in antiquity. It cost so much money, it was so time consuming, and so much effort had to go in to not just writing it, but also making sure it got to the addressees, that you don't just wake up one morning and say, "Oh, you know what? I think I'm going to write a letter today. I think I'm going to write a book. I'm going to talk about the high priesthood of Jesus. Sounds like a great topic." No. These books in the New Testament are occasional. What that means is something prompted their writings. I don't think we have any writing in the New Testament that is not prompted by some historical reality, some situation that occasioned the text. And that's the question here. What is that occasion that compelled the writer of Hebrews to write what he did? All right, well, let's now look at why people thought, and a few people still think, Paul wrote Hebrews. And you may still see this in some English translations. They will have the full title, "The Epistle of the Hebrews Written by Paul." You may have that sometimes, particularly in older translations. First of all, Paul's letters are part of a collection, they're part of a collection in an early group of papyri, P46. This is dated to the 3rd century AD. This is a very, very important witness to the Pauline text and a very early witness. Hebrews is collected among them. What does that mean? Well, that could very well mean that whoever put this collection together, and we have no idea who did that, but whoever put this collection together thought Paul had written it, and so he placed it with the other Pauline writings. That's one piece of external evidence. Is that sufficient? No, because this is 3rd century AD. It doesn't say anything about Paul himself directly. It doesn't say anything about someone who listened to Paul directly. This collection probably took shape maybe in the 2nd or 3rd century. So it's not, I don't think, very strong. Now the second option is perhaps a little bit stronger, and that is Eusebius, who is a church father. He wrote one of the earliest histories of the church that we have, very helpful source of a lot of information. He says Paul wrote it. Clement of Alexandria, 2nd century writer, says Paul wrote it. Origen, a 2nd into 3rd century writer, said Paul wrote it. But you know what's strange about every single one of these witnesses? They all saw that something was different with regard to Hebrews in comparison to the other Pauline epistles. They all admit it. In fact, Origen, in one curious place, he says, "God only knows who wrote Hebrews." Now, elsewhere, Origen affirms Pauline authorship, but in that place, at least, there is some question. So how do we explain it? Well, Eusebius has this notion. I think this is up here. Yeah, Eusebius has this notion. He's quoting Clement of Alexandria. That's what happens in this work by Eusebius. He quotes a lot of these guys, and this is sometimes the only source for this material that we have. Now, let me stop here. You may be thinking, why are we doing this? Okay, this is a good question. But the reason we're doing this is I want you to see the sources for yourselves. I don't want you to take for granted something I say, something somebody else says. I want you to see the sources for yourselves, and you can make up your own mind. You don't have to agree with me. That's not my purpose at all. It's to just give you the information that may not be as easily accessible for you in most cases. Okay, so that's why we're looking at this. So in book 6 of his History of the Church, Eusebius says, "Clement of Alexandria says that the Epistle to the Hebrews is the work of Paul." So there's that attestation that I mentioned a little bit earlier. and that it was written to the Hebrews in the Hebrew language. Now, is Hebrews, as we have it, written in the Hebrew language? No. It's written in Greek. So we've got to explain, well, why do we just have it in Greek? And that's what he does here. But that Luke translated it carefully and published it for the Greeks, and hence the same style of expression is found in this epistle and in the book of Acts. So you see what he's saying? He said Paul wrote it, but Paul wrote it in the Hebrew language. Luke came along, translated it from Hebrew to Greek. Most modern scholars don't take this very seriously, and there's a good reason for that. Hebrews is not translation Greek. We have examples of translation Greek, plenty of examples. It's not Hebrews. As I said earlier, Hebrews rhetorically, grammatically, syntactically is the most sophisticated, and it's not even close. That is not a translation. Okay, so I don't think we can take this very seriously at all, really. Okay, here's what Jerome said, his 4th century Latin father. He said, the epistle, which is called the Epistle to the Hebrews, is not considered his on account of its difference from the others in style and language, but it is reckoned either, according to Tertullian, to be the work of Barnabas. Here we have the mention of Tertullian, who's living in the 2nd century. And by the way, Tertullian is writing in Latin, but he knows Greek, so we can't just dismiss it. He knows Greek better, probably better than any of us will ever know it, okay? Maybe with Tertullian it's a little bit different because that's not his first language. But at any rate, he said Barnabas is the author. Or, according to others, to be by Luke the evangelist or Clement afterwards, bishop of the Church of Rome, who they say arranged and adorned the ideas of Paul in his own language, though to be sure, since Paul was writing the Hebrews and was in disrepute among them, he may have omitted his name from the salutation on this account. So Jerome says it could be Paul, but he doesn't have his name listed because maybe it would have caused some kind of controversy if they had known it was from Paul. Again, he gives us several different options. I don't think any of them are that we should take very seriously. But what does all this mean? Ancient evidence of people, again, who know Greek better than we will ever, are saying something's different about this. They were good enough readers to know something's different about Hebrews. So even though this is used as external evidence, it's still problematic in that regard. Here's some internal evidence for Paul. Some arguments resemble Paul's. I don't think it's that many, to be honest with you. The author has some connection with Timothy. That's it. Those are the only internal arguments. Now, the internal evidence, which do you think stronger, internal or external evidence? Just generally, not here necessarily, just generally, which do you think is stronger? Probably, what? Internal. Yeah, probably internal. So that's it. In this case, the external evidence is actually stronger than the internal evidence. This isn't very strong. I mean, was Paul the only person to know Timothy in antiquity? Of course not. Okay, so that's not, that. I don't think that's very, very strong at all. Some arguments resemble Paul. Is that strong? Well, no, it's not. Again, these are Christians in antiquity writing about Jewish issues. Of course, there's going to be some overlap. But I think what's more significant are the differences you find in Hebrews when you compare Pauline literature. So here's some internal evidence against Paul. This, to me, is the strongest piece of evidence here. And maybe I'm wrong, okay? I'll say that, but I think this is pretty significant. Okay, so in Galatians chapter 1, one of the things he's doing in Galatians, if you recall, is defending his apostleship. How does he do that? Well, he says, I didn't receive this from human beings. Jesus himself gave me this information. Look at what he says. The gospel that was proclaimed by me is not of human origin, for I did not receive it from a human source, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. He goes on down further. When I did not confer with any human being, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but I went away at once into Arabia. Afterwards, I returned to Damascus. It is an explicit reference to firsthand knowledge from Jesus himself. There's no intermediary, right? Is that clear? Yes, I think this is very clear. But the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 3 says this: how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard. Who are those who heard? The apostles. Is this writer an apostle according to this verse? No. He said, we got it from them. I think this is very strong. Now, somebody might say, well, he's using us accommodatively. He doesn't really mean us. He means them, but he's putting himself in their group. I don't think Paul would do that, given how strong he affirms in Galatians and elsewhere that he received this revelation directly from Jesus himself. I don't buy it. I think this is a very strong piece of evidence that Paul is not the author. You know what? It's okay, right? I mean, does the text itself say that Paul's the author anywhere? No, never says that. So, I think this is the strongest evidence we have. Here are some others. The language, as we've already seen, even those second century witnesses to Pauline authorship are not witnesses. Those second century testimonies to Pauline authorship, even they admit the language is different. We've already talked about number two. And then three, some of the themes that the Hebrew writer talks about, you do not find in Paul. And yet, they're talking about issues relevant to a Jewish audience. The biggest problem in the early church was, should Gentiles essentially have to become Christians? Paul says, no, it's not justification by works of the law, it's justification by faith. In Hebrews, the argument's different. It's about the high priesthood of Jesus and the superiority of Jesus to several Old Testament figures. It's not the same. And when I say it's not the same, that doesn't mean it's contradictory. It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying he has a different approach because it's a different guy. Okay? Could Paul talk about the same subject and differently? Yes, he could. But I don't know that he could do it that differently. I mean, for such a huge issue that occasioned Galatians and Romans, and yet if he wrote Hebrews 2, Hebrews also, he's never going to mention it? I find that very difficult to believe. Did you ever hand up? Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah, right. Yeah. Seems that way for sure. Now, there are some people that will question that it's even written to Jews, but I think I'm inclined to agree. I think that's correct. So that's different too. And there are other differences. This is just what I think you know. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes.
Is there speculation as to why the author did not include it? I know you mentioned that in relative to Paul, but not being Paul, any speculation?
No idea. No idea. No. Anything else? Could I be wrong? Yeah. Am I? No. So, let's not. I'm sorry. No, I'm not. So, who then wrote Hebrews? Right? I've heard people say that. If we don't know who wrote this book, then, let me back up. They have a problem if we don't know who wrote the book. I don't see any problem. So, who is it? Well, let's do the second and third one, and then we'll go back to the first point. Barnabas, we've already seen that, has ancient attestation from Tertullian. I don't know where he got that. There's no other tradition that says that. But why would somebody posit Barnabas as the author? Well, he traveled with Paul and others, and so would he know Timothy? Of course. I think that's probably why. Aquila is also another possibility, because Aquila, again, the traveling companion of Paul. And then maybe the most interesting suggestion has been made that it's Priscilla. And if that were the case, this would be the only text, so far as we know, in the New Testament written by a female. I think that would be appealing. There's no way to know that. Apollos has received a lot of support because he fits the characteristics of the first point. But again, what do we know about Apollos as an author? Nothing whatsoever. So I don't think we can say that. Ultimately, as Origen said, God only knows. Now, what can we say about the author for sure? He's an educated Jew. No doubt about it. This guy was educated. He's very familiar with the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint. He's familiar with Greek rhetoric, which was part of the formal education in the Greco-Roman world, rhetoric. But he's also familiar with Greek philosophy, and we'll say a little bit about that. I don't think he sort of draws from that well that often, but he does mention it in a couple of places, or alludes to ideas in Greek philosophy in a couple of places, and so we'll talk about that. Okay, so would that fit Apollos as far as we know? Yeah, it would. But were there other educated Christians of the same ilk as Apollos? Of course. So we can't say whether it's Apollos or anybody else. All right? So, who's the author? We don't know. Can God inspire authors even if we don't know their names? Of course He can. Of course He can. All right? So, anything about this issue? So we've answered the question, who's the author? We don't know. Maybe that's not the answer you want. Well, I'm sorry. Okay, so what is the genre? Well, we've already referred to it. I've already referred to it as an epistle. But does it begin like an epistle? Well, no, it doesn't. Are there aspects of the work that do resemble epistles? Yeah, the last chapter does. But that's about it. Otherwise, it reads like a sermon. And so even the author in 1322 refers to it as a word of exhortation. So some have referred to this as a sermon or homily. I think that's sufficient. The genre of Hebrews is quite unique. In the New Testament, is there anything else like it? Not really. So I think that's as far as we can go. One scholar actually said that this was the literary riddle of the New Testament when he was talking about Hebrews because of the genre issue. There aren't really any parallels, not just in the New Testament, but outside as well. And that's again part of the uniqueness of this work, is there's no comparative material really. Is there comparative material with Revelation of all things? Yes, there are. There are Jewish apocalypses that resemble Revelation, or rather, Revelation resembles them to a degree. Okay, so we even have analogs for that. This is a bit like the Gospels. There's nothing quite like them in antiquity, at least that we have access to. The date, 60 to 100. Would you like to be more specific? I would, but we can't. All right, so let's talk a little bit about why those range of dates, right? What are the reasons behind positing that broad range of a date? Well, one scholar argued that it was written by Apollos, and it was written to the Corinthian church, and 1 Corinthians is actually a reaction to how the congregation at Corinth reacted to the Hebrews. The work to the Hebrews. So many problems with that. and there's a reason why no one takes it seriously. So you see, he dated the work to the 40s. No one dates it to the 40s that's taken seriously. So it begins around 60 to 100. Why 60? Well, the author the author says he is at least one generation, I'm using that a little bit loosely, generation removed from the original apostles, right? Well, that's at least a couple of decades. So that's why 60 is probably a good place to begin. Why 100? Well, that's because it seems like Clement of Rome, this isn't the same Clement I mentioned a little bit earlier. This is Clement of Rome. He wrote a work. When is it dated? Good question. Sometime in the second century. He seems to be quoting, or at least paraphrasing, Hebrews. That's the first time any author quotes from the book or alludes to the book. And by the way, some people don't even think he's doing that. They think he's doing something else. To me, it's too close. And we could have probably looked at that, but I'll spare you from looking at that. So if that's the case, which I think it is, then 100, somewhere around there, has got to be the latest possible point that you could date the book. And there's one question here that's directly related, and that is, he mentions the sacrificial system. So some people have argued, well, if the temple was still standing, it would be bizarre for him to mention the sacrificial system in the present tense. People make a big deal about that. Well, in Hebrews, he mentions the sacrificial system and the practices in the present tense. This, who's a priest after the order of Melchizedek, is superior to the Old Testament priests. Why? Because he's mediator of a better covenant, based on better promises, and he gave a better sacrifice. Better covenant, better promises, better sacrifice. That's why he is superior. Now, again, let's say you've never read this work. You see how much time he devotes to this subject, chapter 4, 14 to 10, 18? Guess what's another major subject? Jesus' superiority to the Old Testament priesthood. Why would he be emphasizing that in particular? He spends a lot more time on this than he does Jesus as being superior to the angels or to Moses. So it's worth asking the question, well, I wonder why he does that, right? And again, we'll try to unpack that later. Finally, the last section is more of a practical nature, I suppose, than what has gone before. So because of this ultimate revelation through Jesus, he says, let us as Christians live with faith and endurance. And that's where we have almost definitely the most well-known chapter in the entire book, and that's Hebrews 11, right? Hebrews 11, Faith's Hall of Fame, as it's sometimes been called, and that's where, remember, the writer brings in all these figures from the Old Testament to make the point that they had faith and to make the point that they had the kind of faith that led them to listen to God's voice. Now, as I said, we're probably more familiar with that chapter than anything else, but here's the question we need to ask. What does that have to do with the rest of the work? Why does he spend so much time on that issue in a work that where faith is emphasized several times, but that's not the main argument necessarily, or we might say, is it? Maybe that's an underlying argument that takes us through the whole work. We'll explore these ideas certainly as we get to chapter 11. All right? Any questions or comments as we conclude this morning? All right. Well, on Wednesday we'll begin the book, and I look forward to it. Appreciate it.